This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. Well, this week we are going to return to Las Vegas, where we're going to talk with the perennial host of Jeff McBride's Wonderground, Mr. Tim Wise. But before we do that, I want to remind everyone about the contest that we started a week ago and we're going to continue this week, and that is that Ken Scott had offered a free registration for the Atlanta Harvest of Magic coming up later in 2021. And all you have to do is just go to the website to episode number 597 or 598, which would be this one. And there is a form that you can fill out with your name and email address, and then it goes into a spreadsheet, and then your name could be randomly drawn. There again, it doesn't matter where you live or in the entire world. This is open globally, wherever this contest is legal in your state or your country. And if your name is drawn and if they continue to have the convention this year, then you get a free registration. Again, just includes registration only and no other expenses and has no cash value. But nevertheless, it could be worth something to you if you're planning on going. Just fill out that form and good luck to you. Also, I want to remind you, if you want to help the Magic Word Podcast, one easy way is just to go to iTunes Store and go to the podcast area, and if you would, just leave a 5-star rating with some sort of a comment. That'd be great. That helps our podcast grow and helps us move up in the rankings, and every little bit helps. It seems like from time to time we do get some nice words of encouragement, and I receive those occasionally via emails. But another way that if you want to share your comments with everyone, the best place would be on iTunes, where that everybody can see it in the world. But if you also want to just share it on the podcast, you can do that because we have a comment area for each episode when you go to the Magic Word Podcast that you can type in your comments or whatever you thought about that particular episode. We continue to get, again, just a lot of really favorable comments that I receive personally through emails and texts and direct messages through Facebook and everything. And so I am so flattered, and I thank you very much for tuning in, dear listener, week after week and listening to this in however and wherever that you listen to this podcast. Well, this week, as I said, we're going to be going back out to Las Vegas, where we're going to speak with Mr. Tim Wise. And Tim is someone who has, as I mentioned, worked with Jeff McBride. And in fact, it was through Jeff's encouragement that led him to get the genie out of the bottle, so to speak. So the genie was formed through Jeff's encouragement. And Tim will tell you that story. Also, it's interesting to hear some of Tim's background in working with David Copperfield and other kinds of ventures that he's involved in doing. So I'm not going to spoil it. I'm going to let you hear this firsthand because this is an episode that is full of stories. And I feel as if that I had to, from time to time, almost kind of cut off Tim midway when he still had more stories to go, just to kind of redirect him, only because he has so many stories to share, and I wanted to get to as many as possible on so many diverse subjects. And I know that you're going to enjoy this week's episode with Mr. Tim Wise here on The Magic Word. Today I have with me a guest from Las Vegas, someone who has been working behind the scenes and in front of the scenes, actually with a lot of people and a lot of places and a lot of things that he's been working on, or whether it's been with Jeff McBride and working at the Wonderground, or whether that it's been working with David Copperfield or Chris Angel, so many different people in the Las Vegas area. But besides that, having toured on the road then with Stan Kramian and Dennis Loomis, and also want to talk about Abbott's, there are so many things that I want to get into, and this is just going to be an enjoyable hour of fun conversation. So please welcome my friend all the way from Las Vegas, Mr. Tim Wise. Hey there, Tim. How are you doing?
Scott Wells. Nice to see you, pal. And I'm doing just fine. Good. Just fine. Thanks for having me today.
Glad to have you here then as well. You're in your workshop then, I see right now. And you got some 3D printers behind you over there. Now, do I understand you have five free, not one, two?
I got about six of them. 3D printing is such a fun experience. And then once you immerse yourself, now I'm creating and actually producing magic with them. But initially I was just printing other people's stuff, you know? Yeah. I got a few of them here now for sure.
So the stuff that you are recording, that you're making over there, are things that are not just gimmicks, but they're actual like props and things, or what kind of stuff?
Well, all right. So when you get a 3D printer, unless you have an experience as a 3D modeler where you can actually create things virtually on your computer and then make that on your printer, it's different when you create your own things, right? Yeah. Because then so when you first start out, though, if you have no experience, you basically go online, you find somebody else that's made something, and then you print it. And you can, fun thing about it is that you can scale it up and down to different sizes, mm-hmm. and kind of manipulate the files a little bit, but it's basically somebody else's stuff. And then as I've gone along here, and there's many great magicians in our business that are like Levent,
right,
and Sean Begonia and Bill Cook, these guys are, using it, especially Sean Begonia. He's one of the first guys that ever had a 3D printer. I mean, going back 10 years ago, and I think he paid over $10,000 or $15,000 for one of the first ones, and now you can do pretty much what he was doing back then on your desktop. So I started creating some stuff with it, and I'm very excited about my new product that's out, and I know you are the benefactor of one of them, and right. It's been really cool. 3D printing is really awesome. I have a background in regular printing. I was a print broker and an account executive back in Ann Arbor in those days, about 15, 20 years ago, and now you can print something physical. It's just pretty cool.
I was just thinking about how that our technology is evolving, certainly, and thinking about Bob Kohler being one of the first people I knew who had a toaster. Oh, I forgot what you call that. But the kind of stuff that he was doing back then, it was so expensive to buy that now you can do easily with, a free software, even, kind of a thing. It's amazing, what we can do with that. And yes, I remember Levent talking at Magic Live, giving a lecture about the stuff that he can make and the different, not just props, but also gimmicks and things you can design for yourself, and you can scan them and whatnot. Anyhow, so, yeah.
Yeah, well, that was another thing. It was like when I was working, with David Copperfield. It was one of the benefit of working, being in Las Vegas, and he needed help in the unboxing of a major magic collection that he had purchased years and years before. And one of my thoughts was, because that was when I first bought my first printer, and I said, if you could get a scanner to scan some of these props, for instance, mm-hmm. That maybe these props could appear in museums without ever having to put the actual prop in a museum. So he could lend out a 3D print of a Okito prop. And it wouldn't be the original prop, but it would be a 3D printed version, and the audience would be able to, or the spectator, whoever's watching it and they're looking at it in the museum, mm-hmm. could see it, but not actually have the actual prop there. And but those 3D scanners were like incredibly expensive, and they've come down in price now. And pretty much you can scan anything, and with a little skill, print it right back out.
Right. Well, speaking of Copperfield, I know that you had worked with him for a number of years then. And were you traveling with him on the road before the
never? No, never really traveled with him. In fact, my relationship with David only became in the last couple of years when I was working with Jeff McBride. And what was really cool is, David is a massive collector of magic. I mean, he's probably got if not the largest magic collection in the world related to our industry. And a few years back, Jeff McBride and the Mystery School, a few of the students were fortunate enough to go over and go to the museum. David was inquiring, I think, talking to Jeff about Tannins. And Jeff had worked at Tannins or had a really good relationship at that time. I know he worked at Flossos for a while. And so one day Jeff said, hey, you want to go over to Copperfield's and go to the museum? And I was like, yeah, I'll be the first guy in front,
Yeah.
And David was at that time putting all these Okito props, the entire just incredible amount of stuff from Okito. And so we went and visited the first day, and then we went back a second time. And I was really proactive when I was there. I was helping them build shelves. And even though I was volunteering, I was wanting to help. I wanted to contribute. And then at one point, he just walked up to me and he says, you know, I need some help around here. You want to come work for me? And I went, sure, I did. I mean, it was like, what an honor.
Yeah.
And David's museum and his dedication to preserving it. Now, unfortunately, it's not open to the public yet. And maybe in the future, you know, he'll do that. But what an honor. I mean, I can't tell you. Opening up boxes of magic collections, and it was like Christmas every day going to work with David Copperfield.
It was stuff I'm sure people had sent him, plus things that he was buying or acquiring from different places around the world and whatnot. So,
well, this particular collection that he needed help unboxing was the Leslie Cole collection.
Okay.
And this was acquired, I believe he bought it now 25 years ago, it was in storage. And he had over 100 boxes or 1,000 boxes. I mean, it's 1,000 boxes that were, you know, pretty big size, 2x3 or better. Stacks and stacks of newspapers from the 1780s. I mean, I can't tell you this collector. This was for Leslie Cole, was the, I believe, the head librarian at the Magic Circle for many, many years in England. And so and Leslie Cole was a collector of collections. So he himself had. Leslie Cole, when he was alive, he collected collections. So when they were up for sale, he'd buy them. And then David acquired Leslie Cole's collection, which was a collection of collections.
Huge. Yeah. So was it just you or other people, I assume, who were unboxing and doing all this?
Well, it was actually Will Bradshaw was the first person that David brought on. And Will was over there. And then I was the second person that came in on this. Now, when first couple days there, we were in this massive area in the museum that was open space with empty bookshelves, knowing that we were going to be unboxing thousands and thousands of books. And so we were just filling, you know, and we were, so that first day, first couple days, Mike Caveney was there, Bill Smith, myself, Jeff McBride, and what a hoot, right? Yeah. You know, we're all eating pizza on the floor with David and, you know, talking about this amazing thing that we were doing. And then, so there wasn't just me. I mean, it certainly wasn't just me. But I'm telling you, like, for a magician, especially because I've had tenure in the business, I've been in a long time, so I knew what I was unboxing.
Sure.
There was things I would open it up and I go, are you kidding? You know, I have, for instance, Eddie Joseph.
Yeah.
Okay. Eddie Joseph was very prolific, wrote a lot for Abbott's Magic and put out a lot of manuscripts and stuff. And here was Eddie Joseph's personal notes, you know, just incredible. Autograph books from magicians that, you know, went from Maskelyne all the way to Paul Daniels, for instance, you know, and it's just amazing. Just, I can't tell you. It's like I said, Christmas every day. I'd open boxes. One box I remember opening up. And there were 4 signed Houdini, the life memoirs of one of the Houdini books. I can't even remember which one it was. Yeah. But they were all autographed. And the value of those were, you know, not in the thousands, but maybe in the 10,000 range, you know. Wow. And they were just sitting in a box, you know. So, without divulging too much about the experience, I'm just going to tell you it was like Christmas every day.
Now, you mentioned that he does not have the library and the collection open, and I know he doesn't. It is a private tour only kind of a thing. I've never heard any plans for them to open this to the public, but have you ever heard him say that he might?
No, I haven't, but okay. I can't imagine, you know, I can't imagine this not being for the benefit someday. But you know, I'm telling you, it's so... the museum tour itself, I mean, there's just open shelves. Nothing's really protected. Right. So you can't have the public just milling in.
That's a good point.
And you can't have more than maybe 2 or 3 people. And honestly, because of the value of everything, you got to keep an eye on everything. And that was, you know, I think that's part of the reason why it can't be a public tour, because things would disappear literally. You know?
Sure. Yeah. And he would trust the magicians because he knows most of us who are going to be coming in on the private tours, and knows that we're going to respect it and appreciate it and not going to take anything, because as you're walking through and you see those little things, it may be certainly easy enough just to pick up a small thing and put it in your pocket. But yeah, you're not going to, obviously. But I could see the public might do that. So you're right.
Yeah, well, it's just nothing's behind plexiglass. You know, I mean, if everything was behind plexiglass, you'd have an area of comfort. But there's just so much. I mean, I don't even know how many thousands of square feet. I mean, but it's in the literally thousands of square feet.
Remember when I went through it, that he was actually physically tripping over some things. There were so many things there. And he had said to one of his assistants, he said, tomorrow, can you do such and such with this and move this? To kind of avoid that, because he's used to these tours and walking through the whole thing, you know, then as well. So I know that he also has a plan, I guess, to build one room, huge room. It's going to be like a library just for books only, which
the library is actually, that's one of the things that the Leslie Cole collection was, I'm not going to say primarily books because there was a lot of stuff, but it was, I'm going to say, it was primarily books, but it was all different subject matters, a circus and occult and other things, but primarily magic. And I was in charge of the periodicals at one point, and you wouldn't believe all the different periodicals over the history of the last 300 years that were put out, mastheads of different names of magic. I mean, it's in different languages. My tail would wag every day. You know, I had keys to the, castle.
Yeah.
And so, and I could go in anytime. And so to go in there and to be able to just, what's your job today? Oh, open up another box of, I don't know, you know,
the mystery boxes. So, yeah, exactly.
Yep, mystery boxes.
Speaking of mysteries and mystery school and Jeff McBride that you had mentioned earlier, I know that he has quite a collection of things, that a lot of stuff that he'd collected from when he was a youth, not necessarily new things that he's been acquiring, but he just has a lot of cool stuff of his own, I guess.
Yes. Wow. What an experience with McBride. And we're still creating together. It's really been great.
You've been the first person to be the MC at the Wonderground of his, right?
Yeah, I mean, he created the Wonderground, I'm trying to get the dates right here, but he had produced it at the Palace Station. And when you look about how hard Jeff McBride works as a performer and as a master of what we do, he had a show called Magic on the Edge, or Magic at the Edge, and it was at the Palace Station 6 nights a week, a full evening show, hour and a half or so program, and he did that 6 nights a week.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in addition to that, he launched a show called The Wonderground, and that show was at the Palace Station, and it was in a separate space from his main show, and he went in and did that show twice a week, Fridays and Saturdays. So he had Wonderground Fridays and Saturdays plus 6 nights a week with his full evening show.
Wow. That he was, doing?
Yeah. He was doing – yeah, it was his own show, Magic at the Edge. And that was a 6 nights a week. And then 2 nights a week, he was producing Wonderground. And he had great people there, like Steve Dacry, you know, just a lot of great guys, right? Yeah. Back from, and I was living in Tennessee at that point, working at Dollywood for Dave Talon at the Magic Shop, and had a little restaurant I owned there as well. And so I was working in Tennessee, and my friend A.J. Olson, who created the Street of Cards broadcast, if anybody has those memories of the Street of Cards, was basically a virtual live show that he would do, a little player and a chat room, and you could interact. And he took the Street of Cards program into the Wonderground. And so then I was in Tennessee, was able to watch twice a week. I was live in Las Vegas, technically, because the chat room created the interactivity. We were able to watch the performances and so on. And so that was so much fun. And then Jeff finished his show, and Wonderground basically went on a pause button. And in that time, when he put it on pause, I ended up moving out west here from Tennessee. I moved out to Needles, California, and took over a resort on the river as managers. McBride, it was only about 100 miles from Vegas, which was really cool, right? Mm-hmm. So I only had to, like, if I wanted to be in Vegas, I could drive 100 miles, spend a couple hours, whatever, come back. It kind of had the best of both worlds, living in the country, in the desert. And then one day, McBride, I used to come to Darwin's Magic Club. That's what I would drive up every week. Every Wednesday, like clockwork, would go up to Darwin's. But then one day, McBride announced that he was bringing Wonderground back. And so my partner Rosie and I said, well, we'll go up and see the show because we were in Tennessee watching it. Like, can't wait to see the show in person. And so we moved it to this little place called The Olive, with a little hookah lounge right off the strip, about 4 miles. And I went to the first one, and I wanted to contribute. Even though I was there, I wanted to contribute, so I offered to take photographs, and because I'm a photographer. And so he says, yeah, go ahead, take pictures, have a good time. So at the end of that night, Jeff come up to me, and he said, hey, I understand you have a resort down in Needles. And I went, yeah, we do. We have a nice place on the river. And he says, well, Abby and I only take 2 vacations a year, and we'd like to come down and spend the holiday with you. And it was around this time of the year, Christmas time. And so I looked at my partner, Rosie. I said, let's get him a nice space. And so he came down, and those 3 days really changed my life in a big way. This is before Wonderground or anything. I hadn't done anything with that yet, only that first one. And when I went there, and he goes, there's probably a reason I'm in your life. And why are you living in Needles, of all places? I said, well, I want to be closer to the magic scene in Vegas. And he says, well, you're in the magic scene. Now what do you want to do? And I said, okay. And then he offered me a week master class there. And I said, well, how am I going to pay for that? And he says, well, I work on a thing called the fee exchange, the fair energy exchange, and perhaps you can help me at Wonderground and you know, we'll work it out. And then that third day he's with me, he says, how would you like to be my stage manager for the Wonderground show? And I went, I'm in, right? So I've actually done more Wondergrounds than Jeff. as he's traveled around the country and or the world, he'd have to leave, and I was left in charge. And so I think we've done over 120 of them, you know, in the 10 years.
Because they're monthly, right?
Yeah, once a month, every third Thursday of the month. Mm-hmm. And we've had such great people on our stage. I mean, really, I've introduced and performed with so many great names. And then, you know, that 10 years in Vegas with Jeff and being associated with the Mystery School, that's opened up vistas for other things. Like David Copperfield, I just mentioned, was because of Jeff's association with David. And now I have a nice relationship with him. And Siegfried and Roy, you know, there's a great story around the genie that I created, the character, but Jeff was the impetus for that.
Tell me about that. What was the genie?
Doing Wonderground, I was the host, right? And so we'd have one of the greatest things in the dynamic of the McBride Wonderground show is that we'd have body painters and tarot readers and go-go dancers and other things happening.
A lot of variety.
In the space.
Yeah.
And so, like, the body painters would be painting, or the canvas painters, too. We had Aria used to come in and paint on the canvas. But they would start the night, and then through the night, they would create their piece. And so by the end of the night, the body painter had somebody completely painted, or a couple of people. The canvas painter had their piece done, and they could show it up in front of the audience. So the body painter, his name was Suzanne Logano, one of the top body painters in the country. She comes up to me and she goes, I'm producing a show called Bad Fairy Ball. And, she wanted me to host it. And I said, well, all right, I'd be happy to host it. So every month before the show, it was like 6 months ahead of time, every month, you're still going to do the show, right, Tim? I said, yeah, of course, Suzanne. So it's the day of the show. And, I'm over at Jeff's house and he brings up, he goes, oh, you're doing that show with Suzanne tonight. And I said, yeah, it's tonight. I can't wait. You know, it's a few hours from now. And I can't wait. He says, well, what are you going to wear? And I said, well, probably my suit.
Yeah.
And he goes, dude, you cannot wear a suit to a fairy ball. I said, all right, well, I don't, I'm limited on my costume. And this is like when I first started working with Jeff, right?
Yeah.
So he says nothing else, Scott. He says nothing else, and we're just moving stuff in his garage. And then at one point he says, hey, Tim, will you do me a favor? I said, sure, what? And he says, here's $50. Would you run up to the dry cleaner and pick up some of my costuming? So innocently, I took the $50, drove over to the dry cleaner. I'm here to get something for Mr. McBride. And this woman brings back a turban and a massive sequined robe. Beautiful. And I picked it up, brought it back to Jeff. I go, here you go, Jeff. He goes, put it on. And I went, what? And he says, put it on. And then he went to this little costume cabinet that he had in his garage, and he had a threw me a pair of baggy pants, kind of like pantalone pants, you know, and a organ grinder shirt, you know, kind of a open white frilly thing.
Yeah.
And so I put that on. I put this amazing robe on, and this robe was from Caesar's Magical Empire.
Oh, okay.
So it was a costume that was made for the Las Vegas show, you know, Caesar's Magical Empire. And it was just sequined, and it was a genie. It had big, broad shoulders and velvet. And so here I am, put this robe on, and then this turban was like, it had big feathers and a big mirror with gems around the center of the, above my eye. And so I put the turban on and I put the robe on, and I'm now looking to find a mirror. And he's always, Jeff, if you ever worked with him, he's always got a little makeup mirror, just a small one on the wall somewhere. And, in his garage, he had a small little mirror. So here I am in this massive costume trying to size myself up in the mirror. I'm looking up and down trying to see myself. And then at one point, Jeff's head pops over my shoulder. And so I'm looking at him in the mirror.
Yeah.
And he says, that's what you wear to a fairy ball. And it was the most majestic costume ever.
Couldn't have been better.
And so, yeah. And so then I was like, well, I'm going to be a genie tonight for all these people at the bad fairy ball. I better, you know, have something to do or say, like give away some scrolls. I was thinking, what do I do? Do I give away scrolls, little sayings about the genie, what the genie might give you as a memento as you.
Yeah.
And so we created some gift magic ideas where I would give away some gemstones. And some Abby McBride also had these things called wish bubbles, where you blow bubbles and then pluck out a crystal out of the air from the bubble, right?
Right.
So so I did the show, and what an honor. Jeff decided to come and actually be in the audience and watch the show. And after the show, he says, great job, and you should take out this genie out on Fremont Street and do magic on the street.
Holy
as
cow.
The genie.
Yeah.
And I went, all right. So the next day, I went out with a pocket full of crystals and hit Fremont Street. And this is way before Fremont Street was regulated for street performers. I basically had a free run as a genie, and I would walk from one end of Fremont to the other every night. And that first night, I went out. I was a photo op. A lot of people wanted to have their photos with me. And so I would take pictures, and it was so much fun because I was in the creation mode of the character. Like, what does his voice sound like? How does he behave? What does he say? So working the street that night, and there was a guy, and this is where Jeff McBride's thing of you have to be in the marketplace in order to have things happen. If you're not in the marketplace, then
it's not gonna happen.
Nothing happens.
Right.
Right. So I'm out there and I'm walking up and down the street, and I noticed this guy was following me. And he had a little little handset microphone on his lapel or on his shoulder. And I always thought that he was the security guard, right?
Yeah.
Like, and security was following
me. Right.
So every time I got him out of the corner of my eye, I would like try to get 10 or 15 steps ahead of him so I wouldn't have to interact with him. Well, at the end of the night, it was probably about 2 a.m, I'm standing down there at Main Street and Fremont, right near the plaza. And this guy walks up and he catches up to me, and he goes, first of all, he walks up to me, and I just keep an eye on him, and then he starts like eyeballing me up and down on my costume. And then he goes, so what's this get up here, you know? And I said, and I was really working out my whole routine. So I just said, I am the genie of good luck, and it's good luck to be standing next to the genie. And he goes, well, that's great. Well, my name's Adam Wright from MTV. And we're doing a show at the Hard Rock Hotel on the penthouse suite in a couple days. And we think you would be awesome to be a part of it. And I say, are you willing? And I went, yeah, sure. Why not? So 2 days later, after that first night being the genie on Fremont Street, I'm at the penthouse suite with hundreds of people film for MTV, and I made an episode of MTV in the first 2 days. And so then the Genie kind of became kind of a staple on Fremont Street, if you will. I was working quite a bit. I made my living out there for quite a while. And then I got a call from Paul Stone, producer in England and United States, done a lot of great work. And he goes, it was about 8 years ago, just before Christmas. And he says, Tim, I'm performing with Siegfried and Roy. I'm going over to the Sunrise Hospital to do some magic for the kids. Would you like to come along? And I went, sure. Are you kidding me? To be Siegfried and Roy? So he says, and if you know any other magicians, let me know. And so I thought about it. I said, I don't know any other magicians that I could recommend. Only because if they messed up, I'd be responsible for bringing him. So I never mentioned anybody else, and Paul was going to do some magic. And so the day, it was Christmas Eve, and it's we're going to be meet over at the hospital about 1 o'clock, noon or something. And about 9:30 in the morning, I'm going, you know what? Siegfried and Roy, as I said to myself, I said, Siegfried and Roy hasn't been on the stage for almost 8 or 9 years at that point. And I said, these young children at the hospital are not going to know Siegfried and Roy.
Who they were, right.
And then I realized that they're not going to know me in a suit, and they're certainly not going to know Paul in a suit. And so I called Paul, and I said, listen, I've been thinking about this, you know, and they're not going to know Siegfried and Roy. They're not going to know you or I. Would it be okay for me to bring the Genie along? And he goes, well, I don't know about that, Tim. Let me call Lynette. So he called Lynette. And Lynette got back and says, well, as long as he doesn't frighten the children with the Genie costume. So I brought the Genie costume, and we got to the hospital. We went up to the ward up on the third or fourth floor there. And I wasn't even really sure how we were going to perform. Were we going to perform for all the children at once, or were we going to go room to room? And so there was kind of a question about how the day was going to go. Mm-hmm. And then Paul got there, and then Siegfried got there, and he saw me in my costume and gives me the once over, you know, with his eyes. And then we realized that Paul was going to do something with a balloon, like latex balloons. And the nurses said, nope, no latex.
Right.
And so then it was just me and Siegfried and Roy. And we went in. It was room to room. And we went into the first room. And I remember I had brought a few effects to do. Right. I didn't know what to do. So I brought a few things to do. And the first effect, I just didn't really go as well as I wanted. So when we came out of the room, I realized that I was just going to do my gifting of the gemstone. And it's basically where the child and I engage them to talk about wishes or dreams. Mm-hmm. And then I have them focus on a wish or dream. And then I make a crystal materialize in association with that wish or dream. So it kind of cements it with the child. So there's a great photo of with me, with Roy in the background, and me over a child who's hooked up to monitors, and his hands are outstretched, and he's holding the gem, and my hands are big and wide.
Right.
And this child's smile is as big as pizza pans. You know, yeah. His eyes are big, and his smile is huge, like a Cheshire cat. And, you know, what an honor. And had I not thought about bringing the Genie, it would never have been the same.
Wow.
So then the next year, they had me come and do the Boys and Girls Club as the Genie. And what an honor, right? To do that with them and have it go so well.
But you were just at the right place at the right time and kind of encouraged to do that then as well, to develop that character and to be in the position where that you can do this over and over. And, of course, being on the street like that then as well. I want to go back for just a minute then also prior to that, because I want to talk about Dennis Loomis and Stan Kramian. I often get the two kind of confused. I know we're going completely out of sync over here. But both those names kind of seems similar to me. I remember, I think it was Stan Kramian who had the magic capades, like Magic on Ice. Wasn't that kind of the guy? Yes.
That's right. Stan Kramian, great showman, right, of the day, one of the great showmen, traveling showman. And Stan was a creator of shows. And so he had how many shows did he did? The Mad World of Magic. Magic Capades. He had another one called, I think, Magic Kazam.
And he would sell these shows off, like at the end after he's finished, and then start all over from scratch, basically, right?
That's right. Right. So, and now we're talking like 1977 is when I joined Dennis Loomis's show, and I was only 16. Mm-hmm. I went to Abbott's Magic Get Together, and Loomis was kind of a fixture there every year, Dennis Loomis. And one year he had made an announcement at the convention that he was looking for assistance for the Magicapade show. Now, I just got my driver's license in June, and here it's August.
You said Loomis and, or Cramian?
Dennis Loomis. Not Cramian, Loomis, because Cramian, I never directly worked with Cramian except for doing some phone room work, you know, where we're calling and selling tickets. Yeah. But I worked on stage with Loomis for over a year. We went to Alaska and that. But during that time at the Abbott's thing, you know, Dennis kind of let it known that he was looking for assistance, and Magic conventions are a really good place to pick up assistants looking for people for work. So I went up to Dennis, and I lived in the same town that Dennis lived in Ann Arbor. And my mother had just moved there, and Hank Morehouse had a magic shop downtown in downtown Ann Arbor. Franz Harari and I were very young magicians that would visit that magic shop every day, pretty much. And so Dennis was at the convention. I saw him, and I said, "Hey, Mr. Loomis, my name is Tim Wise, and I understand you're looking for somebody, and I would love to talk to you about being an assistant on your show." And I said, "And I live in Ann Arbor." He says, "Well, I live in Ann Arbor, too." And I said, "Yeah, I know. I'd love to meet you." So that's all that was said. So that the rest of the convention, I was on fire, right? I was just like, "Oh, my God, I got a chance to maybe do, you know, this."
Right.
And so when I went home after the convention, now mind you, I'm supposed to go back to high school. And, you know, so I get home to my mom's apartment, and I walk in the door, and the first thing I say is, "Mom, I'm home, and I'm going on the road."
Yeah, how'd that go?
And all I heard from upstairs was, "What? Wait a minute." You know, and she came down, and when she came downstairs, I go, "Mom, there's this magician. He wants to meet me. His name is Dennis Loomis. He's got a show," and blah, blah, blah. And she goes, "You got to go back to high school." And I said, "Mom, just let me have a chance to talk to him, you know." And she goes, "All right, well, I'll give you a chance to talk to him." So I met Dennis at the Cottage Inn Pizza right below Hank Morehouse's magic shop on William Street, Ann Arbor. And so I'm sitting there with Dennis, and mind you, I'm 16. I'm just like green as a spring tomato. And he goes, told me all the responsibilities of the show, drive a truck, do two shows a day, build the illusions, take them down, put them in a truck, drive, take care of the animals, clean the costumes. He was trying to, and I just kept going, "Yeah, I can do that. Sure. Yeah. Okay." And so at the end of the interview, he goes, "All right, kid, you got the job." And I went, "Really?" And he says, "Yeah." And then he goes, "Oh, by the way, how old are you?" And I said, "I'm 16. I just got my driver's license." And he just looks at me and shrugged, you know, like his shoulders dropped a little bit. And he just started shaking his head no. And he says, "I'm sorry." I said, "My attorneys would never let me take you on the road. You're too young." And
right.
So I'm sitting across, and I remember this, like I just said, "Well, before you say no, would you talk to my mom?" And he looked at me kind of funny, and he says, "Okay." So I went home, and I said, "Mom, he wants to hire me, but he wants to talk to you."
Okay.
So I arranged for that, or they arranged to get it together, and I remember my mom was head of security at the University of Michigan on the dorms and such. And so they met in some dorm library on campus. And she didn't get up till 6 a.m. So I waited up that whole night for her to get home. And she walked in the door, and I go, "What did he say?" And she says, "Well, he's going to consider it. And he's going to tell you this Sunday at Harry Kohlstock's Corn Roast Magic Meeting this Sunday." So then I was on the edge of my chair, right, to go to this magic club thing that we had. Harry Goldstadt was a great contributor to magic in Ann Arbor, older gentleman. And so I get to the corn roast, and I'm waiting. And every time the door opened, I'm thinking it's Loomis is going to walk through the door, and nothing. He never showed up. And so I just basically didn't think I had the job. Mm-hmm. And so that was on a Sunday. So Monday happened, nothing. Tuesday, Wednesday, I remember being in my mom's apartment. I had my stereo on 10 listening to My Sharona. And I was bopping around my mom's apartment, just bouncing up and down. All of a sudden, the phone on the wall rings, right? So I went over to the stereo, turned it down, and I answered the phone. I go, "Hello?" And he goes, "Tim?" And I go, "Yeah. This is Dennis Loomis calling." I said, "Yes, Dennis." He says, "You still want the job, kid?" I went, yeah. And he says, well, great, because rehearsals start at Tappan Junior High School at 8 o'clock this Friday. We'll see you there. And Tappan Junior High School is a little junior high school in Ann Arbor. So I showed up on time. Mm-hmm. And I remember it like, yeah, I mean, it was 40-something years ago. I remember it like yesterday. We rehearsed for a solid week. And then we had two shows on a Friday the following week and two shows on Saturday. And then the next shows were a week later in Spokane, Washington. So, and that started my touring career with Dennis Loomis. And
quit high school right then? Your mom was cool with that?
Yeah, she allowed me to leave school. Hmm. And I really didn't announce to anybody I was leaving school. I never told the school I was leaving. I just went on the road. And that first 4 months till December was amazing. I went, you know, we started our shows out in Spokane, Washington, and then we were all over up and down the West Coast, Idaho, Oregon, California. Just amazing experience. And then Christmas came, and I still had the opportunity to stay or go, you know, because I had a couple weeks off. Mm-hmm. And I said, no, I'm going back out. And so in January, we went back out. We started in L.A., and then in June, we got news that Dennis wanted to take the show to Alaska. So we drove the Alcan Highway all the way up to Alaska, did the Inland Channel, Haines, Skagway, all the little towns on a ferry boat. We did the shows with a semi truck.
Wow.
Just amazing. So by the time I was 17, I had traveled almost 60,000 miles. We did over 100 cities. And that really, really cemented my belief that this is what I wanted to do for a living. Even though I'd done many other things since then, it was the impetus for showing me that I could have whatever I wanted. You know?
Was there something that you were doing for Dennis at the time that you enjoyed more than others? In other words, you like, were you on stage as an assistant from time to time, or did you like actually building
and
repairing?
No, I was an on-stage male assistant. I got cut in half every show with a P.T. Selbit sawing. And that was Stan Kramian's. And it's really great because there's a photograph of me 2 years before that when Kramian was performing at Abbott's and he needed some assistance to come up on stage. And there I am on stage helping with the Selbit sawing.
Yeah.
2 years before I was going to be in that box. So I found those photos and I go, oh, my God, this was 2 years before I was on the road with Loomis. And that's the same illusion that I was put in every night for a year.
Wow.
Kind of fun. So did I – the onstage performing was always the – that's the fruit. We had to drive. There's sometimes, you know, 300-400 miles between shows, and we have just one night to get there. And, you know, a lot of truck stop diner food and late night, overnight drives and, you know, a lot of – you know, that's the work. Right. That's the business of show business. And then the show is that one hour and a half on stage that we get to perform.
Well, the booking of his show, as you were talking about Stan Kramian having the phone room kind of a thing, was that the same kind of shows that Dennis did?
Yeah. Back in them days, it was called boiler room operations.
Of course.
Yeah. And
I worked a few of those myself.
Yeah. You know, and those
you never know how many people are going to show up.
Yeah, you sell tickets over the phone,
right.
And you get a local sponsor to kind of sponsor the show. You have an advance guy on the road. So Magic Epades had a couple advance promoters that would go into a town. And, you know, back in those days, it was very, very – I mean, a guy would go in, like, let's say if I was the promoter, I would arrive into Needles, California, rent a hotel room, have the phone company come in and put – two or three phones in the room. I would be there for a month. I would hammer the phones and go through the phone book all day, every day to every business saying, hey, you know, the Magic Capade show is coming into town and we're looking at you to sponsor a book of tickets. And the tickets are only $2. Get 10 tickets for $20. How can, you know, can we send somebody out to, you know, give you your tickets? And that's how it was. We would, that's how the shows were done in those days, the road shows anyway. Then the laws came in where you can't solicit without, you know, all the phone being prohibited now. But back in those days, it was phone rooms in every town. And there was times where we would arrive in a town. Let's say we had 2 weeks off and we'd get to the town early. They would put me to work in the phone rooms. And and I worked with some of the best phone guys back in those days. I mean, these guys that could smoke a cigarette and the ash would never fall off the cigarette. It would be stuck to his lip, you know. I remember a guy named Jerry Kay that was just, yeah. And he would always have this, like, cigarette dangling from his lip, and the ash would never fall off of it. It was hilarious.
We'll talk about that. I remember I did an episode with my friend Daniel Summers, and Dan had done a lot of phone room shows himself, and he said that he was very successful and that he had, I don't know what the secret was, he said, but I have something that I do that assures success. And so he was doing these very well, and then, as you said, the laws tightened. Each year got worse and worse to the point it's like completely out of business, and that's like buggy whips now.
Yep. Yeah, well, but that, you know, I can talk about it now. I mean, it's part of my history that's no longer something that can be done.
Yeah. Interesting. And so that came after the Dennis Loomis thing that you met with Stan?
Cranberry? Yeah, well, no, it's funny because it's at the same time. So, okay, Abbott's Magic Get Together, and I think it was 1977, or 76, actually. Stan Kramian sold Magic Capades to Dennis Loomis, and there was a passing of a ceremonial pipe on stage. Hmm. And I heard that there was some illicit substances in the pipe, but I didn't know this at the time. But they had this ritual where Kramian passed the mantle to Loomis.
Yeah.
So then that was the 76. So in 77, Loomis had already toured it for a year, and then he brought it to Abbott's again. He was back at Abbott's, and that's when he kind of announced that he was looking for assistance. And so that was the year that I got hired. Now, when we went out west, we were in Washington State. Kramian's from Vancouver area. And so Magic Capades and whatever show Stan was doing at the time was also crossing paths. So, like, if we were close enough, we would go watch Stan's show, or if they, you know, or vice versa, you know, they would come down and watch our show.
Right.
And so there was just a couple times in that year where I was participating in the phone room work with Stan. So that's when I met Stan Kramian, you know, and actually worked with them to sell tickets. And then there's a magician a couple years later, now I'm 18, 19 now, a couple years later, I got married when I was 19, and I was looking for work. And Mark Evans, a magician out of Salt Lake City, had a show, one of Kramian's shows, called The Mad, Mad, Mad World of Magic. Mm-hmm. And so I went and took my new bride and moved out to Salt Lake City and was working the phone rooms for them. And that lasted for a little while. It wasn't a long-term thing. I moved back to Michigan and ended up doing my own shows. I actually was doing phone room. I found a local sponsor in my own town, Ypsilanti, Michigan, got the Recreation Center to be the sponsor and rented a theater. I mean, so my first phone room shows that I produced were based on the history of working for them. And when I was 19, you know, 18, 19, producing shows. Yeah, so... So much fun. You know, I mean, you're bringing back, when we talk about it, certainly the memories are flooding in. So this is really fun.
Quite an arc then from then till now. There was something you and I were talking about on the phone the other day, and I want to circle back to that was some advice that you were giving. And you know what I'm talking about? The story?
Well, what is your life worth? That one?
That was the one. Yes.
Yeah.
About the story.
Well. So, I'll be happy to share the story with the audience here. And it was very significant. I needed, you know, things come to you when you need it. You know, when your ears are open, you can hear it when maybe 10 minutes before you weren't open to
it. Which kind of leads into the story from everything that you've been saying about how that you were listening to what Jeff was suggesting. And this is for you. You need to have the genie, and how that led into this. And the same thing that you were working with Dennis Loomis, and one thing led to another. And so you just have to be open to that. And so that kind of leads into the story. That's why I wanted to.
Yeah. Open to the possibilities. It's all, you know, so, you know, in this world, there's a lot of fear. Right. And when I learned young, hey, mom, there's this magician. I was 16. Okay, so this is very important for parents. If you're listening and you have children that are interested in something that they really want to do, because I have two children now, and I always, you know, encourage them to be themselves. Is that, you know, in that time, my mom could have said, "No, you're going back to school."
Sure.
That's it, right? And then the trajectory of my life would have been completely different.
We may not have been having this conversation.
Yep, you wouldn't be. And my mom was pretty liberal, and basically said, "I see you, be you." I see you, go be you. And she, you know, she used to take, 1977, let her kid leave high school, go on the road. I mean, I certainly wouldn't have done it myself.
That's quite a hippie thing to say. She was a lady of the 60s, it sounds like.
yeah, exactly. Born in 42 and was, through the 60s, she was in her mid-20s. And so what an opportunity. See, my mom saw something that I, she saw my passion for magic. Mm-hmm. I was really passionate about it, even at that age. So just said go. So one of the things I talk about when I perform at the Magic Castle, there's like four things that I even tell my audience. Like there's four little principles that I have, and one of them is to love yourself first. Mm-hmm. Okay? Love yourself first. And then the second thing is to not be attached to the outcome of anything. Don't be attached to an outcome. So those two things kind of work together, because it's hard to not be attached to an outcome, but you got to love yourself first. And sometimes if you get attached, you're not loving yourself in that moment. The third thing is that there is no emergency in life, that we kind of are in our culture. We're in this emergency mode all the time. Like, someone might cut you off on the highway because they're in a hurry to get somewhere. It's like it's an emergency, and they're only going to their dentist appointment, which could, right. You could be late. But yet people create emergency when really it's not an emergency. Your hair's on fire. That's an emergency. But the rest of the life is like – so there is no emergency. And I think our culture really confuses urgency with emergency.
Good point.
And so, so that's a third thing that I pay attention to. And then the last thing is to say yes as much as possible, but not to your detriment. Like, there's a bottle of liquor there. I'm going to have a couple shots, not the whole bottle. That would be to my detriment. Yes to a little, but not, so always having this gauge of saying yes. So then the story that I'm going to tell you here is when I heard this story, I made some major changes in my life. And it's a story about a little Indian boy who asks his father, "What is my life worth?" Says, "Father, what is my life worth?" And the father says, "Son, do you see that stone right there? I want you to take it to the market. And if anybody asks you if it's for sale, I don't want you to say a word. I want you to nod your head yes. And if they ask you how much, just hold up two fingers." So the little boy takes the stone to the market. He lays it on the ground. And a woman immediately walks up and says, "Little boy, I see you have a stone. Is it for sale?" The little boy nods his head yes. "How much for the stone, little boy?" says the woman. The little boy holds up two fingers. And she goes, "I'd gladly give you $2 for it." The little boy was surprised, and he ran back to his father and says, Father, she wants to give me $2 for the stone." Father says, "Now, son, I want you to take that stone to the city. And if anybody asks you if it's for sale, you just nod your head yes. And if they ask you how much, I want you to hold up two fingers." Little boy remembers what his dad says, grabs the stone, runs to the city, puts it down on the sidewalk. And a man in a suit walks up and says, "Little boy, I see you have a stone. Perhaps is it for sale?" The little boy nods his head yes. "How much for the stone, little boy?" He holds up two fingers. And the man in the suit says, "I'd gladly give you $200 for it." The boy was so surprised, ran back to his father, says, "Father, he'll give me $200 for the stone." The father then says, "Son, I want you to now take that stone to the rare gem dealer. And if he asks you if it's for sale, you just nod your head yes. And if he asks you how much, just hold up two fingers." The boy knew the routine at this point. So he ran to the rare gem dealer. He walks through the door, and the man behind the counter, his eyes get as big as pizza pans. Says, "Little boy, I see you have a stone. Is it for sale?" Little boy nods his head yes. "How much for the stone, little boy?" Holds up two fingers. The man behind the counter says, "I'd gladly give you $200,000 for it." So the little boy runs back to his father and says, "Father, father, father, the man will give me $200,000 for the stone." And the father looks at his son and says, "Now do you see what your life is worth?" The little boy was confused. And the father says, "Son, in life, you need to surround yourself with people who see your value."
Great story. Wow. Yeah.
And when I heard that, how many times in our lives have we been associated with, either in business and relationship, where people don't see your value?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so then you feel defeated, like nobody sees me for who I am. And so when I heard that story, I mean, I made some major, you know, most people go, "Well, why did you do that?" I said, "Because I wasn't seen in the way I need to be seen."
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, people like McBride, who has for 11 years now, has seen my value, what I've contributed to Wonderground, what I've done to the Mystery School, taking his advice and running with it, mm-hmm. You know, working at the, you know, the genie worked at the, getting back to the genie works the Magic Castle twice a year for the kids. Mm-hmm. I mean, here's a persona that could have just sat on a hanger in his garage.
Yeah. You brought right? it to life. Yeah.
And Paul Draper actually commented one time. He says, "Tim, you know, McBride offered me that costume and I never took advantage of it. And you have now made something amazing out of it." And then that costume is in retirement now because I had a new one made that actually was for me. And I, one of the managers at the Magic Castle, Pat Payne, is a seamstress. And I approached her once. I said, "Do you take commission?" She said, "Yeah," because I saw some of the work that she'd done. And she made me this just, I mean, I got about $3,000 in the costume, but it is, it's fitted for me. It's
right.
got all the things where everything needs to be as far as the magic guy's concerned.
All the pockets and all, yeah.
Yeah, and just, I mean, you wouldn't believe it. I've got, there's photos out there of me in this new costume. It's just great. So, you know, what is your life worth? And that's a really good topic or a good question to ask yourself, because then you can start answering the question, why am I doing things?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what is, you know, what's the why? You know, we always go when and how, but what's the why? And so that's kind of my purpose now, is to just kind of find the meaning in the why, right? Why am I doing this? And why am I associated with this person or not associated with this person, and so on and so forth. So, and a lot of great things have come from that, you know?
Well, in that regard, as we start to wrap up over here then, too, is that the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word, and so I always like to know what my guests have as their philosophy of life, and that kind of sums it up, what you said there. And so is there something that gives you joy, something that gives your life meaning to wake up for? What is, not to say a word, but it could be a phrase.
Another great parable. You know, don't be attached to the outcome, really, because you don't know, you know, the future, whatever is coming, you don't know exactly. The universe is going to deliver what it's going to deliver. And mm-hmm. then I believe that everything is divine in our lives. If we look back, it seems like it should have happened, right? If we look back, our lives sometimes are like a movie, like it's
right.
supposed to play out. But it's, everything is divine. You just might not like it very much, you know,
right?
Like, you know, sometimes things are delivered and you don't like them. But, you know, the one of the other parables that I love, there's two of them that I love to tell. And it's just the farmer who had a prize horse, and the horse runs off and leaves the farm. And the neighbor comes up over the fence and says, "Oh, I saw that your prize horse ran away." And the farmer says, "Yeah, well, who's to say what's good or bad?" And then the next day, the horse returns to the farm with 100 wild prize horses in tow. And the neighbor comes up to the fence and goes, "Oh, my goodness, what good fortune. Your horse has returned with all of these wonderful horses." And the farmer says, "Yeah, but who's to say what's good or bad?" And then the next day, the farmer's son is training one of the wild horses and is thrown from the horse and he breaks his leg. And the neighbor comes to the fence and says, "Oh, what a terrible thing to happen. You know, your son broke his leg." And the farmer's response was, "Well, who's to say what's good or bad?" And the very next day, the army comes through the village and takes and recruits all of the young boys. And the farmer's son was spared being recruited. And the neighbor comes to the fence and says, "Oh, isn't it great that your son wasn't taken?" And the farmer says, "Who's to say what's good or bad?" And the story goes on and on and on and on. Right. So my philosophy is to love yourself first. Don't be attached to the outcome. There is no emergency, and to say yes as much as possible, but not to your detriment.
That's great. Good advice. Tim, thanks very much. Thanks. Appreciate your time here today. It's always good chatting with you and getting to deepen our friendship. This has been great.
Well, I can't believe an hour went by in a blink. So thanks a lot.
I knew that it would.
All right. Thanks a lot for having me.
You bet. Thank you. For the Magic Word Podcast, then. That was Tim Wise. This is Scotty out. Thank you, Tim, for being my guest this week on the Magic Word Podcast. I, too, really enjoyed our conversation. The hour did go very quickly, very quickly. I always enjoy our time together, and thank you very much for sharing your thoughts with the rest of the listeners, as well as myself, here on this week's podcast. Well, there are a lot of things that are going on out in our world here today, and I mentioned at the front of the podcast, of course, that we've got this contest which is going on. That Ken Scott is offering a free registration. I want to remind you again to go to this week's episode or last week's episode with Ken, and there you will find a form. The form will disappear, by the way. If you're listening to this too late or far into the future, the form will no longer be there. It's only going to be there for the couple of weeks while the contest is running. But once it's over, then that form will disappear. So it's an opportunity for you to hurry and do that now. Speaking of which, here's another thing that's coming up on February the 14th, which is Sunday. If you are interested in seeing another virtual reality show, then I suggest if you go to HoustonMagic.com. That's Houston Magic, all one word, HoustonMagic.com. There you'll see a link where that you can register for our upcoming banquet. We are having our annual Houston Texas Awards Banquet. And I'm only saying this because this year we're doing it completely different since it's not a real thing, or live, I should say. In the past, we've had hundreds and hundreds, 400 or 500 people who will attend our banquet. Well, this year we're expecting a very large crowd to attend the virtual banquet. And the reason, again, that I'm mentioning it here is because some of the people who will be on and who will be guests that evening have been featured here on the podcast, some of these episodes, and who are friends of yours. So they're not just local magicians, local to Houston, but I think that you might be surprised with some of the names that you see and people that you hear and performances that you get to enjoy from some of my friends and yours that you've heard here on the podcast. So again, go to HoustonMagic.com. There you'll see a link where that you can register for the Zoom meeting, which again is going to be Sunday, February the 14th, 7 o'clock p.m. Central Time. May I also say that when you go to the link to register for the Zoom meeting, and if you get some error message that says page not found or something, it could be just your device that you're using. I know this doesn't work on Androids, and there are some other things that it doesn't work. But if you try to register through your laptop or PC through Chrome or Firefox or other kind of platform, you shouldn't have any problem trying to get registered. So if you have a problem where it says page not found, then I suggest you just try another browser or another way of logging on. It will be just one time, by the way. This is not going to be broadcast. It won't be put on YouTube or Facebook or any place. So you can watch it now or just hear about it later. It's going to be something fun. I was encouraged by, or I should say inspired by, the Academy of Magical Arts whenever in 2020 they did a virtual banquet. And I thought, well, if they can do that, we should try to replicate that as close as we can. It doesn't have the production quality that Jonathan Levitt and others had put together for theirs, but I think ours is going to look pretty good then as well. So enough of that. I think you will enjoy it. But we have some more episodes coming up in the future. We are slowly getting close to that 600th episode. And if you would like to know information about who's going to be coming up from week to week, make sure that you subscribe to our pod letter. And again, if you just go to the Magic Word Podcast, you'll see a little pop-up that should come up on your screen that would say, this is how you subscribe to the pod letter. If not, there'll be a little tab also that will say subscribe to the pod letter. So until next week, stay well, get booked, and remember these good words of advice. Love yourself first. Don't get too attached to the outcome. There is no emergency. And say yes to as much as possible, but not to your detriment. This is Scotty out.